Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. It has been a deadly year for journalists around the globe. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, at least 53 journalists were killed around the world between January 1st and December 14th. Afghanistan was the deadliest country and accounted for much of the increase. The committee also found that fresh waves of repression in China, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia sustained the global crackdown on press freedom this year for the third consecutive year. They found that at least 251 journalists are in jail in relation to their work, and Turkey is the world's worst jailer of journalists. Joining us to talk about these numbers is Dr. Courtney Raj, Advocacy Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists and author of Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, Digital Dissidents and Political Change. As a veteran journalist, researcher, and free expression advocate, Dr. Courtney Raj writes and speaks regularly about the intersection of media, technology, and human rights. Hi, Courtney. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for joining us. The yearly report that you all put out at the committee is so important, but these numbers are pretty dire. And I mentioned the overall number of journalists, 53. You point out that 34 journalists specifically were murdered for their work this year, nearly double the 18 that were targeted for murder in 2017. And these numbers paint a very shocking picture. Give us specifics. What really stands out for you when you do research about those 34 journalists murdered specifically for their work this year?
Sure. I mean, it really was shocking once we, you know, did the analysis of all of the journalists who were killed this year, because, you know, we see that there's kind of this steady number of journalists killed over the past few years, but the serious rise, it was an 88% increase from the prior year in the number of journalists murdered. And so what that is telling us is that journalists are being targeted specifically in reprisal for their reporting. And we also saw that several of these murders took place in countries where we don't usually see journalists murdered, such as the United States, in EU member countries like Slovakia. And we saw, of course, some very high-profile and deeply disturbing murders, like that of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist. He was murdered at the Saudi Arabian consulate in Turkey, and also ongoing murders of journalists in India, Syria, also a place where we discovered that a journalist had been murdered while in custody. So it's just a very bleak situation this year for journalists.
Jamal Khashoggi's death sent shockwaves around the world because of the manner in which he was murdered. What has the impact of his death been on reporters? What are you hearing from reporters around the world?
I think the impact has been pretty significant. I mean, personally, I worked as a journalist in the Middle East for a Saudi news outlet based in the Gulf, so it's both personal and professional in this sense. But what we are hearing from journalists and feeling ourselves is that the impunity and the brashness of this murder, it is unprecedented. We don't have any other cases where a journalist has been lured into, you know, their diplomatic compound and then murdered in such a brutal way with so much, you know, dissembling around what exactly happened. I think that, you know, that murder and the fact that the President of the United States has not come out to, you know, fully condemn what his CIA and the Senate has recognized as being the responsibility of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and continues to make public statements that do not condemn this murder and show that this is absolutely unacceptable and that the United States is going to hold countries accountable for murdering journalists, regardless of whether they're allies. is really problematic. That public statement where President Trump basically weighed in a very public way the cost of this journalist's life compared to, you know, the arms sales and the economic benefits that might accrue to the United States by maintaining this privileged relationship with the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, sent a very, very dangerous signal around the world, because it has basically said and put out in public, which, you know, maybe it took place behind closed doors before, but now, you know, no one has any doubt that, you know, you can basically pay the U.S. off in order not to condemn you around the murder of journalists. And we need exactly the opposite message to be sent, that this is unacceptable and that we cannot maintain normal diplomatic relations if you go around murdering journalists.
Can you talk more, Courtney, about what the significance of a message that the United States sends around the world? Because Martin Chulov, who's a Middle East correspondent for The Guardian, is on our media roundtable fairly regularly, and he talks about this. He says, you know, what the United States says really makes a difference in so many other countries. So specifically when it comes to press freedom under this administration and all of the attacks that we've seen, the verbal attacks on Twitter, the rhetoric around fake news, I mean, this has real consequences around the world. Can you talk more about that?
Absolutely. We are tracking, actually, the impact of President Trump's influence and the U.S. influence around the world. And traditionally, you know, we've always relied on the United States to be a beacon of press freedom. Not that that is a perfect beacon. Certainly, there were issues under previous administrations. Obviously, the mass surveillance that President Obama oversaw and the use of the Espionage Act to target journalists and their sources. But the fact is that rhetorically at the United Nations, in public statements on state visits, the president would stand up for press freedom, would potentially take that opportunity to invite reporters to ask questions, to demonstrate and model, you know, best behavior in terms of how to interact with the press. And we saw, for example, before a trip that President Obama took to Ethiopia, that he consulted with a range of human rights and press freedom organizations. And in fact, right before he went to Ethiopia, they released several of the Zone 9 bloggers. So we can see the impact that the U.S. has. And what we're seeing now over the past couple of years is a very negative impact, as we've been tracking the expansion of this idea of fake news and delegitimizing journalism and journalists as fake news, really resonating with both authoritarian as well as autocratic leaders, and even in some democracies that are taking an illiberal turn, for example, in Poland, Hungary, which is well on its way towards an illiberal democracy. We've seen in Cambodia that it used the excuse of fake news to kick Radio Free Asia out of the country. We've seen in Egypt that President Sisi and his administration have expanded their false news laws and used it to jail more than a dozen journalists. We have seen that the use of false news charges to imprison journalists has jumped significantly in the past 2 years. And we've seen things like the Chinese state news agency and other autocratic news agencies and representatives alluding to President Trump, to his restrictions on access that he grants journalists, to his use of the term fake news as an excuse for their own repressive actions, and saying, you know, hey, it's about time, we've known this all along. But of course, China is regularly the world's, you know, second or very at the very top of the world's jailer of journalists. So that's not who we want to be, you know, congratulating us on our treatment of the press.
Let's spend some time talking about murdered journalists, and then we'll talk about jailed journalists. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists' annual Global Impunity Index, which spotlights places where journalists are regularly murdered, You all found that the 13 journalists killed in Afghanistan were the most in any year since you began keeping track, including 2001 when the United States invaded Afghanistan and 9 journalists were killed, 13 in Afghanistan just this year. Can you talk more about that? What did you find out about how and why these journalists in Afghanistan were murdered?
Well, I mean, Afghanistan is just such a, you know, just such a horrible situation because it was a situation of a double suicide bombing. And this has become, sadly, a common occurrence where a bomb will go off and then, of course, journalists will go to cover it. And then a second bomb may go off and kill them. And that's what happened with these 9 journalists who were killed. And indeed, in this particular case, the second bomber was disguised as a media worker and was carrying a press pass and a camera. So it was even, more horrific. He detonated his bomb amidst a group of reporters. So he was clearly appeared to be targeting these journalists. This was one of the deadliest days on record for the media in Afghanistan. And the bravery of journalists working in Afghanistan really can't be overstated.
So true. How does this affect other journalists in Afghanistan?
I think it has a profound attack. It really is not just an attack on those journalists, but on all journalists in Afghanistan. There remains a lot of violence in Afghanistan, which is by definition newsworthy. And so it impacts the ability of journalists to report the news safely. It has an impact on the global information network, because without these journalists, the world would not know what is going on in Afghanistan. And, Afghanistan is a very dangerous place for journalists. We've tracked at least 35 journalists who were confirmed killed since 1992. And there is no justice for any of these murders. No one is ever held accountable. That's why Afghanistan has been on the impunity index every year since we first published it in 2008. And, it has one of the worst rates in impunity for journalist murders, because they never find or hold to account either the people who carried out the murder or those who murdered them or ordered the murder.
We're joined by Dr. Courtney Raj, Advocacy Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists, and we're talking about the high number of journalists who've been murdered this year. We're also going to talk about the high number of journalists who are currently in jail and have been jailed. You also write about Syria, and you point out that 31 journalists were killed in Syria in 2012. We've had a number of journalists on this year who say they cannot go to Syria because they either cannot get in. It's very dangerous. And your report points out that journalists continue to die in Syria, but the number is down because the access is diminished, which leads to self-censorship or journalists having really no choice but to abandon their work.
Yes, exactly. And we've seen that over the past several years. Obviously, after the high-profile, brutal murders of James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, which, focused the world's attention on the deeply, deeply dangerous situation in Syria for journalists. That was a turning point where you really saw it much more difficult for foreign journalists to enter Syria, and therefore an even greater reliance on local journalists. Now, local journalists are always the most at danger, right? They are on the front lines, and certainly that's no different in Syria. But what happened with the restrictions on access to foreign journalists is it means that, it's up to Syrian journalists and media activists to fill that void. And they have. There are groups like Raqqa Is Being Slaughtered Silently and many others who took it upon themselves to create these media networks to get information out. But what happened, at least with Raqqa Is Being Slaughtered Silently, for example, they were actually tracked down and killed in Syria, and then after they fled to Turkey, some of their members were tracked down and killed, and they got threats in a third country that they had moved to. So it really is evidence of the transnational threat that terrorism and groups like ISIS posed to journalists. And I think that we're seeing, even though you are seeing a few, you know, you're seeing some opening for journalists to go back into Syria, to cover Syria, but it remains incredibly dangerous. You know, 9 out of the 11 journalists that were killed in crossfire last year died in Syria or Yemen. And, you know, 125 journalists have been killed since 2011. So that's an extremely high number.
The report also found that in Yemen, 3 journalists were killed this year. In Iraq, you could not confirm that any journalists were killed because of their work for the very first time since 2012. So that's some positive news. And then 2 Palestinian journalists were shot and killed by Israeli soldiers while they were covering the uprising and the protests in Gaza.
Yeah, you know, the Middle East continues to be one of the most dangerous places in the world for journalists. And Yemen is again deadly, in part because of the Saudi-led coalition bombing, which of course is supported by U.S. weaponry and expertise. And you know, that included the bombing of an Ansar Allah-controlled radio broadcast center, which killed an engineer there. And there was, you know, Yemen has just become a very dangerous place for journalists. And again, as you mentioned about access in Syria, it's also very difficult for journalists to get in and cover. And in Iraq, as you mentioned, it's a little bit of a ray of light. Iraq has been the first deadliest country for journalists for several years now. And so it was a good step in some ways to see that there were no journalists killed. On the other hand, I think we also have to question, why is this? Because of greater self-censorship, greater restrictions on access? It's not clear. And the fact is that there is near 100% impunity for the murder of journalists in Iraq. So despite being the deadliest country in the world for journalists, historically, there have been no one has ever been held to account for those murders. And in Israel-Palestine, in the occupied territories, it was really disturbing to see that Israeli defense forces fired on journalists, and that in the majority of IDF attacks on journalists during the protests between March and May, that they involved live fire. And of course, that puts journalists at great danger. We documented 13 more cases of journalists who were attacked by Israeli defense forces during the Gaza protests, and 7 journalists who were injured by tear gas canisters, as well as live rounds of fire and shrapnel. So it's, you know, really dangerous no matter what side you're covering. And we just have to recognize the grave risks that journalists take to bring us the news.
The Committee to Protect Journalists Executive Director Joel Simon sent a letter to Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister, in April, calling for an investigation, a review of IDF policies on protests and journalists after these killings. Have you received any response to this letter? Do you know?
I do not believe that we have received a response, but I'm not 100% sure. We do track when we get responses to our letters, but I think that we have been disappointed with the response of Israel. You know, we have offices in New York, in Washington, and of course, correspondents around the world. So there are many places that they could engage on this. And I think that it's really important that, you know, the Prime Minister and review military policy on how the military addresses mass protests and how they can ensure that journalists who are covering those protests are not targeted. And I don't think that we are satisfied with the lack of investigation that is, you know, a thorough investigation to hold those accountable for who shot the journalists. And we would like to see better and more engagement with the Israeli authorities. We are always happy to speak with any government who would like to address these issues and figure out with us how can journalists stay safe. So we hope to hear back from Israel soon, but we'll keep trying.
Today we're joined by Dr. Courtney Raj, Advocacy Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. We're talking about journalists who have been murdered and journalists who've been jailed. Let's talk about journalists who are in jail, Courtney. According to your reports, fresh waves of repression in China, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia sustained the global crackdown on press freedom in 2018. At least 251 journalists are in jail in relation to their work. Turkey is the world's worst jailer of journalists. And then back in August, you also put out information about Iran ordering at least 7 journalists jailed and flogged over protest coverage. So let's go over a few of those. Turkey, for example, and then we'll talk about other countries. Turkey has the most number of journalists in jail right now?
Turkey has the ignoble honor of being the world's leading jailer of journalists 3 years running. It's pretty shocking that, you know, one of the world, you know, a democracy, a one of the world's most, you know, famous tourist destinations is also the world's leading jailer of journalists. And the fact is that crackdown on independent journalism actually began a few months before the attempted coup and really took on, you know, just steamrolled in the months and years following that attempted coup. And so what we've seen is a decimation of the independent media, an attempt to completely throttle and control the message and the media, and not only the arrest of journalists, but taking over those media outlets. In some cases, they destroyed the archives of the media outlet. I mean, just really punitive action against journalists that is part of this wider crackdown on civil society in Turkey. And, you know, journalists not only face imprisonment, but have been forced into exile in order to avoid being imprisoned. And there have been some cases where they've tried to, you know, extrajudiciously get them back from overseas. So it's a really, really challenging and difficult time for press freedom in Turkey. And it's been very odd and interesting to see how President Erdogan has, I think, leveraged the murder of Jamal Khashoggi to slowly trickle out information that is very important for helping us understand what happened. But at the same time, one has to wonder how much is that a calculation to revamp his image or something, given that, you know, Turkey is the leading jailer of journalists 3 years in a row.
You also focus on Egypt. Egypt jailed the most journalists on false news charges. In Egypt, at least 25 journalists are in prison as the administration of President El-Sisi has increasingly arrested journalists and added them to existing mass trials. You specifically write about one instance, one example, Mohamed Ibrahim, a blogger known as Mohamed Oxygen, who covers allegations of election irregularities and police abuse. He's one of more than 40 defendants in one case charged with false news and being members of a banned group.
Yeah, Egypt is just personally one of the most devastating cases that we've seen over the past few years, where it went from, you know, before the uprising and overthrow of the regime there, you know, they didn't really jail journalists. That wasn't really one of their tactics. Maybe they would have one editor that they would put in jail to kind of send a signal. But there was some level of independent media, you know, some, you know, allowance for some level of independence. But we have just seen a massive crackdown under President Sisi, with 28 journalists now imprisoned on false news charges, which is up from just 9 2 years ago. But again, I think that you know, President Sisi has probably seen around the world how false news and this idea of fake news has been legitimized. And so we see several more journalists in prison there. This situation of journalists being added to these mass trials, which, first of all, of course, a mass trial cannot possibly have due process or be in accordance with rule of law and international standards. But the fact is that Egypt has held these mass trials, wrapped up journalists in it, arrested and imprisoned them, And then in some cases, like with Mahmoud Abu Zayed, another case, he's known as Shaukan, who's a photojournalist who was covering Muslim Brotherhood protests in Rabah in 2013. He was actually ordered to be released and then was never let out of prison. So it's just a really, really challenging time in Egypt now for the press, very difficult to do independent journalism, and it seems that the authorities there have little to no interest in journalists. You know, in Egypt, they even have a law that makes it a criminal act to publish or disseminate statistics about terrorism that do not accord with the official Ministry of Interior statistics. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous there.
Wow. Well, huge respect to all of these journalists who do such important work. We didn't have time to talk about the journalists in Iran, but this report came out in August. Have you done any updates on the number of journalists in Iran who are currently jailed?
Yes. So in Iran, we did that special report over the summer because we were concerned about what was happening there. And so we do our annual prison census once a year because it's actually not very easy to get this information. It takes a lot of time and research and, you know, trying to get information. And so, you know, it's very difficult. So in the most recent information that we have now on our prison census, we see that Iran continues to be an area of concern, but there were some improvements in Iran over the past years. But, you know, I think we're deeply concerned about what the administration, you know, there's a lot of internal rife in Iran over who is in power, and so there continue to be journalists imprisoned there. You know, that protests remain a very dangerous time for journalists, not only in Iran, but around the world, including in the United States.
Well, again, huge respect to all of these journalists and huge respect to you and all of your colleagues at the Committee to Protect Journalists for putting together these very important projects and reports. Dr. Courtney Raj is Advocacy Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists and author of Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt. Courtney, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for putting your spotlight on this issue.
Yep, it's very important. Thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Coming up after a short break, we'll be joined by the New York Review of Books' Michael Massing, who notes that Donald Trump is both the product and a servant of an entrenched system, one that news organizations generally fail to challenge. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Joining us now is Michael Massing, contributor to The Nation magazine and the New York Review of Books. He's former executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review and author of Fatal Discord. Over the last year, Michael has done some great reporting on journalism in the age of Trump. A couple of months ago, actually, it's already been 6 months. The time just flies by so fast. Michael Massing wrote a very important story about Donald Trump called Journalism in the Age of Trump. And Michael writes that Donald Trump is the product and the servant of an entrenched system, one that news organizations generally fail to challenge. And we talked a lot about how so many important issues are not covered because so many media outlets are focused on Trump 24/7. Let's see if we have Michael there. Michael, are you with us?
I am. I'm sorry I had been cut off earlier. Good to see you. Talk to you.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Michael. This is our last live media roundtable of the year, and we wanted to have you on to talk about, again, the year in journalism under Trump. But before we do that, I just want to ask you, Michael, we just spent about 30 minutes talking with Courtney Raj of the Committee to Protect Journalists about the rise of the number of journalists who have been murdered specifically because of the reporting that they do. Also, the number of people in jail. This is such a disturbing trend. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, I've been involved with the Committee to Protect Journalists from the beginning. I'm one of the co-founders, so I've seen trends come and go. When we started, Latin America was the main area of danger for journalists. I mean, so many disappearances. Now Latin America, except for Mexico, of course, has improved in some respects, but we see in so many other countries terrible times. And I think that what you're finding is that it's linked to the way that authoritarian governments around the world have taken root in places like the Philippines and in Turkey. And China has certainly long been a major repressor of journalists. So I think that as the world becomes, and then in Eastern Europe, in places like Hungary, we thought the EU and everything was going to be just as smooth sailing, and yet all these turbulence in world politics and these polarization and divisions going on have led to journalists trying to expose things and then governments cracking down on them. So it's terrible to see that it's such a worldwide trend.
What do you think the Trump effect has been, specifically his ongoing attacks on the media and praise for autocrats around the world?
Well, two dimensions to that. I mean, clearly Trump has helped to encourage trends of that sort. In America, his attacks on the press have been terrible, and particularly you see online threats of journalists. But thankfully, in terms of the freedom of the press to operate here, it's still very vigorous. But he has clearly encouraged people. The question is, I mean, would that still be going on, or would that not have been the case otherwise? You have a country like the Philippines, which has just gotten so terribly dangerous for journalists. Duterte, I mean, would he not be doing that if Trump weren't sort of doing the things he were? I don't know. These people sort of have these tendencies in any case. So, yes, it is an encouragement, but I think there's also a lot that's just following its own momentum.
Michael, we had you on, I think it was back in August. You wrote a lengthy, really great piece called Journalism in the Age of Trump: Has the Preoccupation with Trump Pushed Aside Other Urgent Stories? Well, here we are 6 months later, and I'd love to hear your analysis about, the media and where we are right now. How do you think the media have done? I mean, it's a big question, and there's obviously different types of media, broadcast, newspaper.
I have in front of me today's New York Times. I thought that this question would come up, and so the banner headline about Jim Mattis's resignation. Then there is below it a news analysis about Trump and a jittery capital, then another President Barks' spending deal, and then another about threats to the Mueller investigation. So the whole top half of the Times today is about Trump and Washington. And, of course, very newsworthy things are going on in Washington, and they deserve coverage. But this is symptomatic of what I see as this ongoing question, both in coverage of America and the world. I mean, there's such a focus on what's going on in the Capitol and on our coast and our big cities where most news organizations are based. And in terms of, like, the rest of the country, the press is doing better, They realize that leading up to the Trump's election, that so much was going on that they were not in real on the ground touch with, and so they've done better in trying to do it. But there's just these structural factors that conditions that apply where there is such a obsession with Trump, both by the press and their readers and their viewers. I don't know, Rose, if you spend much time watching CNN, but as part of my occupational needs, I do, and it's not much fun. It's just nonstop about Trump, Washington, Democrats versus Republicans, red versus blue, and it works. Their viewership is very high compared to the past. The profits are tremendous. The New York Times subscriptions, Washington Post levels of subscription are at record highs. So this stuff sells, and I fear, though, that it's part of an ongoing self-feeding mechanism where, this is what people want, the press gives it to them, and many other things are going on that just don't get much attention, and then, lo and behold, they come up and they'll bite you in the future.
Right. And with cable news, of course, there's so much money to be made with television ads. Michael, when you talk with colleagues about these issues, like the people who make the decision, the editors, for example, what are those conversations like?
So I have talked to the editors, editors at the Washington Post and New York Times, and it's frustrating, actually, because I feel that what has happened is that because of Trump's attacks on the press, that they're the enemy of the people, fake news, it's created a sort of a natural defensiveness. And there is a tendency to say, oh, we are just reporting the facts. We have the facts. We're reporting the truth. I don't know if you've seen, if you get the New York Times on paper, but they have full-page ads, the truth. We never, it never wavers. It's facts, this and that. And the Washington Post, of course, democracy dies in darkness, a slogan that is actually after, I mean, it's come in for a bit of, some sardonic reviews, I think. Editors of the Washington Post, commonly they say, we're just doing our job. I hear that over and over again. And there's no level, I just feel, of self-awareness or self-criticism. And if you offer any, I think you get readily tuned out, as I have sort of personally experienced. It's hard to even create a ripple these days with anything that goes against the grain of what everybody's reporting.
You, in your piece, How Not to Cover America for the American Prospect, you write about how local newspapers are shrinking and many of the national media are closing local bureaus. So we increasingly depend on coverage by reporters who parachute in communities. And in that piece, you wrote about the mea culpa that the Times published in May 2004, acknowledging its failure to more aggressively question the Bush administration's case for invading Iraq. You also write, after the financial collapse of 2008, there was no note, but there was much discussion as to whether the paper paid sufficient attention to the warning signs. Three times in 13 years, the Times faltered badly on a story of critical importance. And you say it's not just the Times, it's really the nation's top news organizations. You know, after the election, it was like the media had this, the national media, especially papers, had a conversation about, you know, what did we get wrong? Where do you think we are right now as we head into 2019 with now we're hearing all about the 2020 presidential election? Especially on
And I fear we're setting ourselves up again to repeat what happened. I feel that there was a big effort at first to make up for what was seen as a breakdown in the period leading up to the election. The New York Times, as I talk about in that article for the American Prospect, set up a unit called Fault Lines, and the idea was to look at the fault lines, to go out into the country and look at divisions and what are the root causes. And so there were a number of good stories that appeared. The Washington Post had a number as well. But that unit, Fault Lines, after a period of time was disbanded. It doesn't exist anymore. The Washington Post still does not have, virtually has no national bureaus. They were disbanded, and what was it, 2009, I think, the last of their national bureaus closed, and they feel that they can cover Washington, the country from Washington by sending out very good qualified people, and they certainly do have many. And, you know, I have to give credit to some of our papers like the Times and the Post for continuing to do a very good job. But I just feel that they are suffering from the same sort of blind spots that the political establishment in general is. And you just pick up pick up the Times or Post, or as I said, CNN, MSNBC, we'll leave Fox aside for the moment, and you just find this absorption with Trump, Washington politics, inside the Beltway, to use a tired phrase itself. And I just don't see the type of deep-seated correction that's needed. And if I can also add one thing, Rose, it's sort of, which I write about at the end of that article, it's not only what's happening on the ground in, say, the middle of the country, it's why. What are the forces that are causing so much a sort of disruption and sort of disillusionment in the country? And I feel there's this failure to make the sort of this, again, to use a common phrase, Wall Street-Main Street connection, that so many of the decisions made by our financial system are having repercussions out in, you know, cities and smaller communities in the Midwest, or even on the coast in our cities. And there's a failure, really, to explain to people why these things are happening, like how private equity companies have become such a force in our economy and are buying up so many companies, and then often laying people off and bringing in new management and then selling these companies for a big profit and padding their own bottom line. So I just see the press sort of, there's this sort of pack mentality of everybody reporting on the same thing over and over again. And again, I have to qualify that and just say there's a lot of good, tough reporting being done. But I would like to see more of the type I'm talking about.
Today we're speaking with Michael Massing, contributor to The Nation and the New York Review of Books. He's former executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review and author of Fatal Discord. You can find his work at yourcallradio.org. I guess I feel pretty lucky, Michael, because we're an independent station and we talk about these issues on a regular basis about inequality, the homeless crisis, and we can go deep because we have an hour to talk about the systemic problems and, you know, how we got here. What are your thoughts about that? And I'm thinking right now about the economic realities for tens of millions of people. So many people struggling to make ends meet, hustling with three different jobs. I mean, we just did a show about all the strikes that have taken place this year, from fast food restaurants to Kaiser to Marriott Hotel. And, you know, I find that, like you said, every night I look at the Times, the Post, other papers, and you can find a gem of a piece about what's happening in a certain town. But, you know, once in a while, they'll go into details about how we got here, about how it's been like a 40, 50-year plan, neoliberalism, what have you. But what are your thoughts about that? I mean, in some cases, you really have to search for these pieces.
Yeah, and even then, I feel they really don't get to the nub of what's going on. I'm looking at some pieces. I clip pieces from the paper that sort of both are promising, but don't really go deep enough. I mean, here's one about how the banking system, for instance. I mean, as a result of the 2008 crisis, we obviously have a lot more regulation. We have Dodd-Frank, even though it's been watered down some. The banks have many more controls. In spite of that, there's been such concentration in the banking industry. Today, the top 10 banks in the United States control about 80% of all the financial assets in the system, which is well more than double what it was 20 years ago. Hedge funds, as I said, private equity, these have become giant forces that are, and as you say, that's a systemic question. And I keep asking myself, why aren't these matters covered more and the impact that they have on the country? Now, occasionally it happens. The whole Toys R Us debacle, where you had a hedge fund buy that, and private equity company bought that, and they did what they often do, slash costs, laid off people, closed stores, don't invest for the long run. That type of thing, I guess because Toys R Us is such a visible and beloved company, got a lot of coverage. But in general, you don't find that going on. And frankly, I don't know why. I don't know why this happens. I do talk to my reporter friends, and they are, like at the New York Times, and they write or point out correctly, look at this story, look at that. But as you're saying, they're episodic, and they don't really show you how the system works. I have all these people whose names I write down who are major hedge fund people, major private equity people, BlackRock, the biggest company, and they control $6 trillion in money. They manage that money. That's more money than the German GDP. And yet, does anybody know them and what they do? I mean, how do places like this remain invisible? I just don't understand it.
Well, you ended one of your latest pieces really asking why. You know, you write, Trump is the product and the servant of an entrenched system, one that news organizations shrink from challenging. Why? Because writing about the way things really work would endanger journalists' access to sources, because it would provoke an outcry from powerful people. And I think this is a great way to end your piece, but pretty chilling. You write, the preoccupation with Trump has pushed aside many urgent stories, not the least of which are the economic and political realities that propelled his rise, and that, if not fully covered and addressed, could prolong his stay in office.
Yep, I think that that is really the dynamic that I'm trying to convey, that I still feel, in spite of everything that happened, we're seeing it in many places. Look at the Yellow Jacket movement in France. I just found that fascinating. Here you have, it's sort of similar, right? You have these people in the periphery outside the main cities who are just undergoing things similar to what people in many communities in America are undergoing, or in Britain, which helped lead to the Brexit vote, catching everybody by surprise. Now, the journalists are doing a quick job of trying to catch up with this, but they are out of touch. They are out of touch with what's going on. I even see this here in New York, and maybe you do in San Francisco as well, even in my own circles. I mean, people are always talking about the Trump voter this and the Trump voter that, without having any real direct experience of who these people are. And I feel our, you know, it's the bubble, which I've written about, and others as well, that people just get caught up in their own world, and it's not for a lack of interest, but people want to hear about Trump, right? They want to hear about Washington. The Yellow Jackets, I just feel, is a phenomenon that brings home once again how journalists congregate in big cities and then have to play catch-up when things happen on the ground, rather than be ahead of things and give us warning signals about these sort of disruptive forces that develop.
Yeah, I was just reading that the Yellow Vest protesters are also in Portugal. They stopped traffic today, and they're also now spreading to Taiwan.
So really? This is really That's very interesting.
Off. Yeah.
Yellow Jackets, off. I guess vest is, I guess they're wearing vest, yeah.
Which yeah, they're wearing vest.
The government in France requires them to buy because, you know, it's a safety device when you're on a road. So they have to pay for it themselves, and it's just another complaint. And, you know, the EU in general is just so poorly covered. I mean, I am always been a big enthusiast for the European Union, given the book you mentioned, Fatal Discord. I write about sort of the disruption in Europe that the Reformation caused in the 16th century. And the EU, you know, finally Europe decided we've killed one another enough. We need a new system with out borders and cooperation and so on and so forth. And yet the EU has become itself in many ways, you know, captive of elitist forces and of banks. And how much reporting is there on that? How much reporting is there on, like, what reforms are needed in the EU to make it work? I could go on and on about that, but these are all symptomatic of this broader question we're talking about how journalists are part of, you know, a world that for all the cosmopolitan and worldliness is parochial in its own way, and really just still, in my view, remains too much out of touch with what's going on outside the big metropolitan areas.
Michael, we have just a couple minutes left, and I just want to ask you to talk about some of the big stories this year that stand out for you, because as much as there's so much to criticize in the media, there's also some really great reporting. I was just reading this morning, ProPublica has an explosive piece called In Immigrant Children's Shelters, Sexual Assault Cases Are Open and Shut. I mean, a horrific story, but so important to shine a light on this. What other stories really stand out for you this year that made a big difference?
Well, it's good, you know, that you're pointing that out. Certainly the efforts on the environment and the pullback of rules on that guidelines for fuel efficiency, the opening up of wilderness to potential drilling, things like that. I'm trying to think in terms, again, of the area that I always want to see more is sort of how does our system work and the financial world and the impact it has. So I don't know. Can you think of something there? See, I get frustrated again that I feel that there are all these stories that focus on this sort of excesses of Trump. But you're absolutely right. The migration story has been very good. I mean, we've also been and here in New York, the poor state of public housing. I mean, it's scandalous. Mm-hmm. The New York Times had a story about a family that has gone 12 years without heat. Here in the middle of New York City, just the level of negligence has been extraordinary. Poverty, how has that become? I'm trying to think, what do you think of that? Has that gotten enough, you know, the teacher strikes that have gone on? But these are political events that need to be covered. So the Amazon pushback has been very interesting. The whole tech story I find fascinating. In the last minute we might have, I mean, for years the press was so enthusiastic and bullish about big tech, and I used to pull my hair at sort of how that you know, the lack of critical mentality. Now, boy, you can't pick up the paper without everybody talking about the size, the invasion of privacy, the manipulation, you know, the advertising model that is leading to so many abuses. You know, some of that's very good, even though that itself has become part of a giant story that everybody loves.
Well, we'll give a shout out to the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. They do a great job on poverty and inequality.
Yes, I know.
Michael, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for joining us. Michael Massing is contributor to The Nation and the New York Review of Books. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. This is our last live show of the year. I want to give a huge shout out and thanks to Malihe Razazan and Laura Wenis, and we will be back live right after the new year. Have a peaceful holiday. This is Your Call. Thanks for joining us.